Chapter 66. The tropical sun beat warmly on the deck of the Mariana Explorer as she rounded the rocky lava finger of Kahakahakea Point. The Numa ship's captain, Bill Stenzeth, slowed the vessel as it entered the mouth of the now familiar cove in Keliuli Bay. Ahead and to his left, he noted a red marker buoy bobbing on the surface. 70 feet beneath it lay the mangled remains of the Avarga Oil Company drill ship, partially buried under a pile of loose lava rock. With the depths shallowing, Stenzeth took the research ship no farther, stopping engines and then dropping anchor. Keliuli Bay, he announced, turning toward the rear of the bridge. Seated at a mahogany chart table, Pitt was examining a coastal chart of Hawaii with a magnifying glass. Unfurled beside the map was the cheetah skin he had retrieved from Lee Hunt's crashed Fokker in the Gobi Desert. Pitt's children, Dirk and Summer, stood nearby, looking over their father's shoulder with curiosity. "So, this is the scene of the crime," the elder Pitt said, rising from the table and peering out the window. He stretched his arms and yawned, tired from his recent flight from Ulaanbaatar to Honolulu via Irkutsk and Tokyo. The warm, humid air felt refreshing on his skin after leaving Mongolia during a late summer cold snap that had snow flurries in the air when he boarded his flight. Pitt's return to Hawaii brought with it a certain melancholy, which deepened during his layover in Honolulu. With a 3-hour wait for his commuter flight to Hilo, he rented a car and drove across the Kulau Mountains to the east shore of Oahu. Off a side road near Kailua Beach, he wandered into a tiny cemetery that overlooked the ocean. It was a small but well-maintained patch of green surrounded by lush foliage. Pitt sauntered methodically through the grounds, examining the assorted tombstones. Beneath the shadowy branches of a blossoming plumeria tree, he found the gravesite of Summer Moran, his first and deepest love, and the mother of his children. Summer Moran had died only recently. Pitt had not known she was alive and living in seclusion after a disfiguring accident, believing that she had died decades earlier. He had lived the years trying to purge her memory from his mind and heart until the sudden arrival of his 2 grown children on his doorstep. A flood of emotions returned, and he painfully wondered how his life would have been different had he known she was alive and raising their 2 children. He had forged a close bond with the kids now, and he had the love of his wife, Lauren. But the feeling of loss remained, tinged with anger at losing the time he could have spent with her. With heaviness in his chest, he gathered up a handful of the fragrant plumeria blossoms and sprinkled them gently over her grave. For a long while, he stood wistfully by her side, staring out at the ocean. The gentle rolling waves from his other love, the sea, helped wash away the pain he felt. He finally stepped from the cemetery tired and drained, but with a renewed sense of hopefulness. Standing on the bridge now with his children, he felt a warm glow, knowing a part of Summer still lived. The adventuresome spirit rekindled, he refocused on the mystery Chinese shipwreck. The marker buoy is where Summer laid waste to the drill ship. Dirk smiled, pointing out the window. "The Chinese wreck site is almost in the dead center of the cove," he said, swinging his arm around to the right. "The artifacts have all dated to at least the 13th century?" Pitt asked. "Everything has indicated as much," Summer replied. "The ceramic pieces recovered date from the late Song to the early Yuan dynasties. The wood samples came up elm and date to approximately 1280. The famed Chinese shipyard of Longjiang used elm and other woods in their ship construction, which is another piece of confirming evidence." "The local geological records don't hurt either," Dirk said. "Since the wreck was devoured by a lava flow, we checked the known history of volcanic eruptions on the Big Island. Although Kilauea is the best known and most active volcano, Hualalai and Mauna Loa also have a recent history of activity. The closest to our spot here, Mauna Loa, has erupted 36 times in the last 150 years. She's had an untold number of lava releases in the centuries prior. Local geologists have been able to radiocarbon date charcoal samplings recovered from beneath the lava flows. One lava sample study from neighboring Pohue Bay dates around 800 years old. We don't know for sure if the lava flows that washed into the cove and buried our ship were from that same eruption, but my money says it was. If so, then our ship would have arrived no later than 1300 AD. Does anything correlate with your cryptic cheetah skin? Summer asked. It is impossible to date, but the voyage depicted shows some interesting similarities, Pitt replied. The lead vessel is a mammoth four-masted junk, which seems to match the size of your wreck, based on the rudder uncovered by Dirk and Jack. Unfortunately, there was no narrative accompanying the images. Only a few decipherable words appear on the skin, which translates as a lasting voyage to paradise. Pitt sat down and studied the two-dimensional artistry on the animal skin again. The series of drawings clearly showed a four-masted junk at sail with two smaller support ships. Several panels depicted a long ocean voyage until the ships arrived at a cluster of islands. Though crudely marked, the islands lay in the same relative position as the largest of Hawaii's eight islands. The large junk was shown landing on the biggest island, anchoring near a cave at the base of a high cliff. The final panel was what most intrigued Pitt. It showed the moored ship near some crates at the base of the cliff. Fire and smoke enveloped the ship and the surrounding landside. Pitt studied a flag burning on the ship's mast with particular interest. The volcanic eruption fits like a glove, he said. The flames in the drawing looked like a brush fire, but that's the secret. It wasn't a fire at all, but a volcanic eruption. Those crates, Summer said. They must contain some sort of treasure or valuables. Tong, or Borgin, as you've said his real name is, knew something about the ship's cargo. That's why they were trying to open up the lava field with a directed earthquake. I guess the laugh is on them, Dirk said. The treasure, or whatever it is, wasn't even on the ship. If the drawing is correct, then the cargo was taken ashore and destroyed by the lava flows. Was it destroyed? Pitt asked, with a wily grin. How could it have survived the lava flows? Summer asked. She picked up the magnifying glass and studied the last panel. Her eyebrows arched just a trace as she studied the crates surrounded by black stone. The image showed no flames on or about the crates. They're not on fire in the picture. Do you really think they could have survived? I'd say it's worth a look. Let's go get wet and find out for sure. But would it have to be buried in lava? Dirk protested. Have a little faith in the old man, Pitt smiled, then headed off the bridge. With a high degree of skepticism, Dirk and Summer followed their father to the rear of the ship and assembled three sets of dive gear. Loaded into a Zodiac, they were lowered over the side of the ship by Jack Dahlgren. I'll have a tequila waiting for the first person who finds a Ming vase, he joked as he cast off the rubber boat. Don't forget the salt and lime, Summer shouted back. Pitt steered the Zodiac toward the shore, angling to one side of the cove before killing the motor a few yards from the surf line. Dirk tossed an anchor over the side to secure their position, then the threesome slid into their dive gear. We'll run parallel to shore, as close to the surf line as we can get, Pitt instructed. Just watch out for the breakers. And what exactly are we looking for? Dirk asked. A stairway to heaven. His father smiled cryptically, then pulled his mask down over his face. Sitting on the edge of the boat, he leaned over backward and dropped into the water, disappearing under a small wave. Dirk and Summer quickly adjusted their masks and regulators, then followed him over the side. They converged on the bottom, less than 20 feet below, in water that was dark and turbid. The crashing surf roiled the water with foam and silt, reducing the visibility to just a few feet. Summer saw her father nod at her, then turn and head into the murk. She quickly followed behind, knowing her brother would take up the rear. The bottom surface was a bed of craggy black lava that rose up sharply to her left. Even underwater, she was pushed strongly from the side by the incoming waves, and she frequently turned seaward and kicked hard with her fins to avoid being body slammed into a rising mount of lava. She followed her father's fins and trail of bubbles for 20 minutes before he finally disappeared for good into the dark waters ahead of her. She figured they were roughly halfway across the cove's landfall shore. She would swim another 10 minutes, she decided, then surface and find out exactly where she was. Following the surf line, she felt herself being carried close to a lava rise by a large wave. Turning to kick away, she was surprised by a second, more powerful wave, which pushed her forcefully toward shore. The wave quickly overpowered her, and she slammed backward into the lava wall, her steel air tank grinding against the rock. Unhurt by the collision, she remained pinned against the lava until the wave rolled past. She started to move away when she noticed a dark spot on the rocks above her head. Pulling herself closer, she peered into a black tube that angled slightly upward and toward the shoreline. She couldn't tell in the murky water whether it was just a hole in the rocks, so she pulled out a flashlight and reached inside. The beam of light faded in the water, not detecting an opposing wall to reflect. The opening clearly traveled for some distance. Her heart skipped a beat as she realized that this was what her father was searching for. She braced herself by the opening as another large wave passed by, then reached around and banged the flashlight against her dive tank. A metallic clanging echoed through the water. Almost immediately, Dirk appeared, looking at Summer quizzically, then eyeing the opening with surprise as she pointed the way. A minute later, her father swam up, playfully patting Summer on the head after spotting the tunnel. Flicking on his own flashlight, he swam into the tube, his kids following behind. Pitt immediately recognized the opening as a lava tube. Its cylindrical shaped walls were almost perfectly formed, rounded and smoothed as if made by a machine. But the passage was actually the result of a steady flow of hot lava cooling on the surface and creating an outer crust. The liquid center ultimately flowed out, leaving a hollow tube. Lava tubes have been found that stretch 50 feet wide, while a few run several miles long. Summer's tube was relatively small, stretching about 6 feet in diameter. Pitt followed the tube for 30 feet, noticing a gradual ascent on his depth gauge. The tube suddenly flared wide, and he noticed a reflection from his flashlight just before his head broke the surface of a calm pool of water. Bobbing on the surface, he turned the light around him. Steep, black walls of lava fell vertically to the water on three sides. The fourth side, however, opened to a wide, rocky clearing. Pitt kicked lazily toward the landing as the underwater lights of Summer and Dirk surfaced near him. They all swam to the rocks and climbed out of the water before anyone spat out their regulators and spoke.
"It's amazing," Summer said. "An underground cavern fed from a flooded lava tube.
Though it could use a little air conditioning." The air in the cave was dank and musty, and Summer contemplated keeping her tank and regulator on. It was likely a much deeper cave at one time, but became sealed off by the lava flows gushing down the mountainside, Pitt said. It's a fluke that a lava tube happened to form at its entrance. Dirk dropped his tank and weight belt, then flashed his light around the clearing.
Something caught his eye in the rocks. Summer, behind you. She turned and gasped at the sight of a man standing just a few feet away. She stifled a cry at realizing that the man wasn't real. A clay warrior? Dirk asked. Summer shined her light and noticed another figure standing nearby. They were both life-sized figures with painted uniforms and sculpted swords. Summer crept closer, eyeing the artisan's detail. They were soldiers, and each had braided hair and a stringy mustache beneath almond-shaped eyes. Emperor Qin's terracotta warriors of Xi'an, Pitt said. Or perhaps a 13th century facsimile. Summer looked at her father quizzically. 13th century? What are they doing here? Pitt stepped up to the two figures and noticed a small path that ran between them, cut through the lava. I think they are guiding us to the answer, he said. Stepping between the clay sculptures, he followed the path, with Dirk and Summer in tow. The worn trail twisted around several walls of lava, then suddenly opened into a wide, cavernous room. Pitt stood at the threshold with his two children, shining their flashlights in awe. The huge chamber was filled with an army of clay figures flanking the walls. Each wore a heavy necklace of gold or an amulet studded with gemstones. Positioned inside the clay warriors was another ring of sculptures, mostly scale figures of animals. Some were carved jade or stone, while others were gilded with gold. Deer grazed fearlessly next to large falcons. A pair of prancing white mares was showcased near the center of the room. Interspersed with the sculptures were dozens of small lacquered cabinets and tables covered in dust. On a large teak table, Summer noticed an elaborate place setting that shone under her light. The plates, flatware, and goblets sitting atop a silk mat were all cast in gold. Adjacent to the table was an assortment of silver and gold ornaments, some adorned with Arabic lettering and literary Chinese script. Other tables held mirrors, boxes, and art objects glistening with decorative gemstones. Summer crept to a nearby cabinet covered with scenes of battle painted in bright colors and pulled open a drawer. Inside, trays of amber, sapphires, and rubies filled the silk-lined case. The sculptures and jewels didn't interest Pitt. He stared past the artifacts toward the centerpiece of the entire chamber. On a raised stone platform in the middle of the room stood a long wooden box. It was painted bright yellow and featured detailed carvings on each panel. Pitt stepped closer and shined his light at the top of the box. A stuffed cheetah, its teeth bared and a clawed paw scratching the air, seemed to hiss back at Pitt. He lowered his light to the top surface of the box and smiled at the image. A large wolf, painted blue, was emblazoned across the surface. May I present the late emperor of the Yuan Empire, Kublai Khan, he said. Kublai Khan, Summer whispered in reverence, her eyes wide. It can't be. I thought he was buried somewhere near Genghis, Dirk said. According to popular legend. But the tale just didn't seem to add up. Borjin was able to locate the grave of Genghis Khan with his seismic device, but he never found Kublai. They should have been buried in the same ballpark. Then your Dr. Tong appears here, sidestepping a mission to disrupt the Alaska pipeline in order to visit a shipwreck? There was obviously a greater draw, something only the Borjins could appreciate. I suspect they may have found an empty tomb for Kublai in Mongolia, or discovered some other clue that he was buried elsewhere. I still don't see how that leads here, Summer said. The story is in the cheetah skin. It was discovered at Shangtu, so it had an original link with Kublai.
The emperor was known to possess trained cheetahs used for hunting, so the skin may have even come from one of his pets. More relevant was that the cheetah skin was unearthed together with a silk map that purportedly showed the location of Genghis Khan's tomb. Borjin's father acquired the silk map, and Borjin himself admitted that it helped lead to the gravesite. For some reason, the significance of the cheetah skin paintings was overlooked when first found. The blue wolf was the trigger for me. "What blue wolf?" Summer asked. "A design motif," he said, pointing to the image painted on the elevated wooden coffin. It was a known emblem for the imperial Khans, originated by Genghis. If you look at the cheetah skin closely, you can see a banner of a blue wolf flying on the mast of the burning junk in the last painting. It wouldn't be flown except in the presence of a Khan. Your wreck, which matched the depiction of a royal vessel departing China on the panels, was dated 50 years after the death of Genghis. Too late for him to be taking a cruise. No. The dates align with the era when Kublai ruled and died. The secret of the cheetah skin is that it shows the final voyage of Kublai Khan. "But why was he brought to Hawaii?" Summer asked, passing her light across the length of the sarcophagus. She held the beam momentarily on a twisted wooden staff that leaned against one end of the tomb. She noted, curiously, that a shark-tooth necklace dangled from its worn grip. His last years were difficult ones. Perhaps his voyage to paradise was a plan to spend eternity on a faraway shore. "Dad, how did you know his tomb survived the volcanic blast and that we could find it?" Dirk asked. Whoever painted the cheetah skin had seen the tomb and treasures and had known they survived the lava flows, otherwise they would have been depicted in flames as well. I took a gamble on the entrance. The sea levels are higher than they were 800 years ago, so I figured the entrance might now be underwater. The treasures here must represent the riches accumulated during his lifetime of conquest, Dirk said, stunned at the sheer volume around him. Perhaps some of the items were amassed during the reign of Genghis as well. It must be worth an untold fortune. The Mongolian people were cheated out of Genghis Khan's treasure. It would only be fitting if they secure the riches of Kublai Khan. I trust they will find a more appropriate burial spot on Burkhan Khaldun, where Kublai can spend eternity. The wonder of the hidden tomb played heavily on their inner thoughts, and the trio found themselves whispering as they roamed through the ancient treasures. Illuminated by just the glow of their flashlights, the shadowy chamber teemed with the mystery and aura of the Middle Ages. As the beams of light played off the glistening walls, Pitt was reminded of the real Xanadu and the haunting poem by Samuel Coleridge. "The shadow of the dome of pleasure floated midway on the waves," he recited in a low voice, "where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves." Summer approached her father and squeezed his hand. "Mom always told us you were a hopeless romantic," she smiled. Their lights running low, Pitt and Summer moved together toward the passageway. Dirk sidled up as they took a last look around the chamber. "First, you save the tomb of Genghis. Now you discover Kublai Khan and the treasures of his empire," he said with awe. "That's one for the ages." Summer nodded in agreement. "Dad, sometimes you are just amazing." Pitt reached his arms out wide and gave both his kids an affectionate hug. "No," he replied with a broad grin. "Sometimes I'm just lucky." This is Scott Brick. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Treasure of Khan by Clive Cussler and Dirk Cussler. Published by arrangement with G.P. Putnam Sons, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated. Text copyright 2006 by Sandecker RLLP. Production copyright 2006 Penguin Audio, a division of Penguin Group USA Incorporated, and Books on Tape.